A Podshape production.
It was a sunny Saturday in Adelaide on the 25th of August 1973. It was getting close to footy finals time, and Les and Kathy Ratcliffe and their young son David and daughter Joanne were excited to watch their beloved Norwood on the Redlegs play.
The Rover will put it forward from centre wing towards centre half forward. Hobby in the front spot. Couldn't pull it down. Knocked on intelligently by Sorrell. Full mark for that one over the Grimwood. He's slow, the little Rover, but gets his boot in towards the goal just in time to squeak.
On the other side of town, four-year-old Kirsty Gordon was not as excited about a football game, but she was excited about being with her nan for the day, who was a Norwood fan and was planning to take her granddaughter to her fortnightly ritual at Adelaide Oval. The day started like any other, but by the time the sun went down, two families' lives were changed forever.
Well, of all the baffling crimes that have been committed in this city, few are more heartbreaking than the disappearance of Kirsty Gordon and Joanne Ratcliffe.
We're particularly looking for information concerning the happenings at the Adelaide Oval during the last quarter of the game.
This is Little Lost Girls. Episode 6, The Only One Left. Susie Ratcliffe has lived for the last 47 years, never hearing her sister Joanne's voice. She's made it a life's mission to not only try and find closure for her family, but to help other families who have suffered loss due to a long-term missing person. Susie hasn't been alone in the search. Countless police officers have been on the case from the early 70s.
Even though Cole Lehman's been long retired from the police force, it's a case he can never forget.
I had a very good staff on. Quite a few detectives and so forth working with me. Many out in the field and, of course, men in the operations room, sifting through everything that came in.
Her brother David, her mum and dad, along with the Australian public, have all tried to help to find an answer to this almost 50-year-old mystery. I wanted to know if Susie was happy with the police efforts over the last 47 years.
Yes and no. I know that, you know, back when the girls first disappeared, the circumstances surrounding the disappearance were unique. The police had never really dealt with anything like it other than the Beaumont children 7 years prior. So they were still, you know, finding their feet, for want of a better saying. So it was something different for them. They didn't have the use of technology like we do today. There was no CCTV footage. You know, they didn't have social media like we do now. I mean, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram play an integral part in a lot of our society nowadays. So it was quite difficult for them back then. Of course, you know, DNA testing and stuff like that was, you know, it was still in its infancy. The fact that it was in such a public area and there was very little of any evidence left behind, it was an incredibly difficult investigation right from the start. Over the years, we've had some questionable contact or lack of contact from police. I mean, I understand that there are so many cases of missing persons and homicides going on every day, but it doesn't take much for a 5-minute phone call to a family to say, look, we haven't forgotten you. We're still piecing together, you know, information. We're still working on your daughter's case. The lack of contact was a great concern and has been an ongoing concern, especially for me, because I've watched my mum, you know, slowly give up hope. You know, I watched my brother, go through the agony of the realisation that in all likelihood we'll never be able to bring her home and bury her before they pass. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened.
They believe there are still people out there that know what happened here that day, and they're pleading with them to come forward.
I want to be able to lay my dad's tortured soul to rest
And I want to be able to look my mum in the face and say, Mum, we're bringing Sissy home.
I would like the police to keep working on our case. And not just our case, but, you know, everybody's cases. Because I don't want this passed on to a next generation. I don't want my daughter to have to pick up the fight and to pick up the push to locate her Auntie Joanne. Or my nieces or their kids. You know, we all deserve to be able to bring her home. And if there's, you know, evidence in the case files that can do that, then, you know, I certainly want the police to work hard on that, as does every family that has a missing person. You know, it's something that, you know, until you're actually walking in the shoes of having a missing loved one, you don't understand the concept of the pain and the loss through this ambiguous suffering. It has been difficult knowing that, you know, police have lost evidence over the years or didn't follow up phone calls that were made to Crime Stoppers or didn't, you know, question, you know, certain people. You know, there's just been a bit of, not disinterest, but just, I don't know, just a lack of empathy to some degree from the police. And, you know, it's just, yeah, just it does irk me that, you know, some things have been overlooked, you know, and, you know, we're just hoping that with this, the new detective that's on, you know, with the girl's case now, that he has that passion and drive to do what needs to be done.
Over the space of the 47 years that the girls have been missing, you can imagine the case has changed hands multiple times. It's important to note that Susie is not unhappy with the police efforts, but does wish that over the long period, there was a bit more care and attention shown to her sister's case. And she hopes that the new officer in charge can show as much empathy as the initial two detectives that worked on the case way back in the early days.
We had a number of detectives. Like near the start, we had John McCall and John Atwood, two fantastic detectives that, you know, they became friends of the family, not just detectives. They took it on board. It was not something that at the end of the day they close the books and go home and not think about the case until the next day, next time that they're at work. It was something that consumed them, and they got to the point where we weren't just, you know, another case file. We were friends. You know, my mum, up until the day she passed away, was still receiving Christmas cards from John McCall's wife. You know, we were invited to his funeral. You know, mum, you know, watched the kids grow up. So there was certainly a closeness with those two. But after they were sort of retired or left the force, it was, we had a number of detectives on the case. But, you know, as mum said to me once, like, you know, she didn't even know who was investigating the case through different periods of time, because nobody would contact her. It was only if, you know, they'd suddenly got information, or, you know, the papers or the TV were going to come out with something, that they'd ring mum and go, oh, you know, this is coming out, or this has happened, be prepared. And then in later years, they didn't even do that.
It's been a difficult year for Susie and her family. She told us earlier of her own battle with mental health and how it affected her search for closure.
I suppose I've sort of let it slacken a little bit. I haven't been the dog hounding them, which ideally I shouldn't have to do. I mean, it should be, you know, them sort of contacting the families. Initially, when he first started on the case, he kept in regular contact. He went out and met mum at my brother's house in Adelaide. But, you know, as you know, inevitably they have to have to take themselves away from the case to investigate other cases, because unfortunately there are so many more homicides and missing persons happening every day. So we can't just have them dedicated just to our case. But I've spoken with the victims of crime officer a number of times over the last 18 months, so she's been keeping me up to date with what's been going on. There's always phone calls into Crime Stoppers about the girl's case. There's been numerous calls, and unfortunately the police can't sort of say whether it's a crank call or it's viable information, so they have to investigate every single call that comes in, which, you know, can lead them on a wild goose chase. It takes up precious time, and so you know, that's been quite disheartening. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, as time goes on, you know, people pass away, people get dementia or Alzheimer's, so information that they may have could be forgotten. And unfortunately, it's, you know, it's heartbreaking to know that we might not ever locate the girls. But in so saying that, I'm not going to give up hope. You know, hope is all we have, and if I give that up, then we've got nothing.
As I'm talking to Susie on a Zoom call, she's in a Melbourne home. We're seeing each other down a computer screen, but I notice behind her there's a single photo on the mantel. It's the same photo that Susie, as a child, used to sneak out of her bedroom while her mum and dad were consoling each other in another room and talk to. It's a picture of her sister, the sister she never met, her big sister Joanne.
But yeah, she's there. She's also on my mantelpiece that we look at right next to the TV. So she's always there. And I'll actually get it and show it to you. Hang on. She's in a better frame now. Yeah, she's been knocked around a few times, but she's, and the photo itself is, I had it enlarged because it was only a little one initially.
There's so much pain surrounding Susie's life. It's unimaginable to try and comprehend how she feels and how losing a brother and a mum and the sister she never knew impacted her life. Her work would leave a light on, adds a glimmer of hope to those who are suffering from ambiguous loss, but never dulls the pain that Susie must feel. I've never asked Susie this question before, and it seems an obvious one, but I wanted to know what she thinks happened to her sister Joanne.
I believe that an incredibly evil person with no forethought to anyone else but himself abducted the two girls with extremely horrific intentions in mind. I believe that Kirsty was the main target and Joanne ended up being collateral damage because she wouldn't give up Kirsty without a fight.
And do you believe that person that took them, one of the two people that have been mentioned as people of interest?
I do. I have strong belief that Hart was behind it. Whether he was part of a larger party of pedophiles that, you know, were so big back in the day. You know, there's that possibility, and there's been a lot of talk around that. You know, being that Yatna was a place where children were taken. I have a book that was given to me by a lovely gentleman who We grew up in an orphanage in Adelaide. He was put through an emotional turmoil as a child growing up in that orphanage. He was the victim of a lot of sexual abuse at the hands of a lot of different people. His strength and tenacity to survive that and go on to be an advocate against child abuse and sexual abuse against children, and to raise awareness of not what just he went through, but hundreds if not thousands of other boys and girls went through at the hands of these pedophiles. But he has spoken of numerous get-togethers, to put it nicely, in Yatna, which of course is where Stanley Hart resided. And so my belief is that, you know, the girls were possibly taken for one of those get-togethers initially, as I said, Kirsty being the target. But because Joanne wouldn't give up and wouldn't let go, he's taken both of them.
When you read that letter from Stanley Hart's grandson, how difficult was that to read?
Took me over a week. The first couple of pages wasn't too bad, and I thought to myself, I don't know what Brian's on about, because he said, he did warn me, he said, look, it's pretty graphic, you know, make sure you don't read it alone, have someone there with you. Stupid me, didn't, you know, I was like, I'll be right, yeah, I can do this, can't be that bad. Sat down with a coffee while I'm home alone, and read the first couple of pages. I thought, I don't know what he's on about, it's not that bad. But then as I got further, I was like, oh my God. I think the biggest thing that got me was his description of going to the dam and one of the barrels lid had come off, and he saw Joanne inside that barrel with crabs crawling out of her face from cavities that they'd chewed into. That undone me. It took me a long time to get that vision out of my head. But it's something that, you know, I force myself to continue with, but it's, as I said, it took me about a week to get through. Emotionally, it really unhinged me. And then I confided to my brother that I'd read the statement. And he got quite upset with me for putting myself through that. And I think that was pretty much the beginning of when I realised that I had to take a step back from being so immersed in Joanne's case and sort of really delving myself into the investigation as I was doing. You know, my brother and my sister-in-law both said to me that they were extremely worried about me and my mental health. They were worried I was going to go down the same sort of lines as my dad. And that was a huge wake-up call for me. And that's when I realised that, you know, I needed to take a step back.
2020 has been a difficult year for most of Australia and the world with COVID. 2020 is even more difficult for you because in April you had some terrible news.
Yeah. 2020 has certainly been a year that I would quite happily forget. 2020 has been 2 years that I'd like to forget. In April, I got the news that my brother had passed away. He'd had a heart attack and died in the arms of his wife. 2 weeks short, or 2 months short, sorry, of his 60th birthday. You never expect the call, or you can never prepare yourself, you know, for anything like this. But last year when I lost Mum, I was prepared to a certain point because I knew her health was deteriorating, that she wasn't well, and that, you know, every day that we had with her was an extra blessing. But to get the call that David was gone, it floored me. Like, it felt like somebody had come up and just ripped the rug right out from underneath my feet, and I was falling. It was just so unexpected. I'd only spoken with him, you know, the previous week, and, you know, just joking on the phone and, you know, listening to him rambling on about his bloody camper trailer. It was just, you know, it was such a shock, and I couldn't grasp it. I thought, oh, you know, someone's playing some, you know, stupid joke. This is ridiculous. And it just, at that point, I just thought, you know, I'm it. I'm the last of the immediate Ratcliffe family, and it floored me to think that, you know, we've fought so hard for so long, and everything that I've been fighting for it hasn't been worth it, because I haven't got, you know, my brother or my mum to give them the answers that they've longed for so long. So I did hit an extremely deep hole. And I'm not afraid to admit that I have been diagnosed with depression and anxiety, which I was diagnosed after Mum passed away last year. And, you know, I so often speak to family members of missing loved ones, I plead with them that if they're feeling, you know, emotions like I have been, to please go and speak with their doctor, to speak with a counsellor, because I hit a really dark patch. Now, I will admit that it was a really deep, dark patch after David died. I think the only thing that kept me going was my daughter, who's 14 years old, and my partner. You know, they kept the drive in me. They kept me, you know, with that rational thinking. But, you know, it's something that, you know, it was a hard struggle, and there are still days now that I have a dark day. But I remember Mum's mantra: keep putting one foot in front of the other. You know, get up out of bed, put your do your hair and makeup, have your shower, get yourself ready. Even if you're not doing anything through the day, just sitting on your bum watching TV, always get yourself up and ready. So, you know, Mum's still here with me, you know, chanting in my ear.
How has what happened to your sister changed you as a parent with your own daughter?
Oh, I'm certainly one of those helicopter parents. Although, you know, my blades have sort of dwindled a bit over the years. When she was younger, I was very, very overprotective. I had to pull myself back a number of times because I thought to myself, look, I don't want her growing up like I did, where I couldn't go anywhere or do anything, couldn't go visit my friends because Mum and my brother were so petrified that the same thing had happened to me as what happened to my sister. So I had to be really careful about those steps I took with Tamara. In saying that, she is very much aware of stranger danger. She has been, we taught her at a very young age how to defend herself, what to say, what to do if someone tried to take her. My brother and I taught her a few defensive moves, which we know does work, because my brother, bless him, poor bugger, he come home early from work one day and we were around there visiting his wife. And he snuck up behind Tamara. We were out in the front yard. He snuck up behind her and went to give her a bear hug from behind. And she put her defensive moves into play. And he ended up flat on the grass, rolling around, swearing that his nether regions were in the back of his throat. it works. She's now actually doing karate. So, which is something that... I recommend for all people to learn, not just, kids, but adults as well, to learn some form of defensive moves, because you just never know when you might be put in that position that you need to defend yourself.
Among families like mine who have suffered from a family member go missing, the Leave a Light On Foundation is a shining light in some really dark days. Susie and the work that a small team do for nothing more than to help find answers shows that in a selfish world where most people are content to look after themselves, people like Susie Ratcliffe are there to help.
Oh, thank you. I don't do this for personal gratification or notoriety. Certainly don't do it for the money, because I volunteer all of this. I do countless hours of work on Leave a Light On each and every day because it touches my heart. These families that I've come to know over the years, they're not just families of a missing person. A lot of these cases touch my heart deeply. And, each and every single missing person is important to me. I don't care about their age or their race or their religion, their ethnicity, what skeletons they might have in their closet. All of these people are someone's loved one.
Her strength across the past 47 years is inspiring. You can help Susie by visiting the Leave a Light Facebook page and sharing any stories you think are relevant.
Because at the end of the day, I don't want their loved ones to be forgotten. They'll never be forgotten by their family. But the general public need to know that these people are loved and they're missed. And it doesn't matter if they've been missing for 3 months, 3 years, 30 years or longer. They're still thought of every day. They're still missed every day, and there's always those thousands of questions that plague families that they just wish they had answers for.
My final question is in relation to Kirsty and Joanne. What do you hope for?
I just hope to be able to locate their remains, bring them home, be able to bury them alongside my mum. My dad's ashes were scattered across the oval. So unfortunately we can't bury her with him. But just knowing that, we've finally brought her home and buried her with the love, dignity and respect she and Kirsty deserve is what's most important to me. I gave up worrying about justice and finding out who did it and why they did it or anything. Like, I don't care about any of that. I just want to be able to bring the girls home. We deserve that. You know, we deserve that opportunity, as do thousands of other families. So, you know, my greatest hope is that someone out there that has information finds it within themselves to come forward. You know, ring Crime Stoppers, send anonymous notes to Crime Stoppers or to police. You know, they don't have to give their name if they don't want to. They can remain anonymous. But, you know, I think to myself, you know, there's $1 million reward out there on offer. And that's a million reasons to make that call, to give our families some form of resolution.
There are over 38,000 long-term missing person cases in Australia, and the story you've just heard is one of them. We want to continue to help bring these emotional stories of ambiguous loss to you so we can spread the word and hopefully get some closure for the families. For as little as the price of a coffee a month, you can help support us to keep creating this content. Just head to our Patreon page. The link is in the show notes.